from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump versus everybody in Houston, Apple versus the FBI, the battle over the Supreme Court seat, more mass shootings, wild weather. Super Tuesday's just around the corner, and the candidates are feeling it. Donald Trump was at the center of many attacks in last night's GOP debate in Houston.
Donald, I understand rules
Mr.
are very
Trump,
hard
you're
for
doing
you.
A great
very confusing.
Job. I have his book.
Okay,
yeah,
now
on your reality
Trump,
TV show,
great.
Not in
thank
Donald,
you, thank you for the book.
Wild. Bernie Sanders backers fighting hard. Hillary Clinton picked up a win in Nevada.
Some may have doubted us, but we never doubted each other.
And the battle between Apple and the Justice Department swells. Apple CEO Tim Cook said the FBI is what it's asking is big, and there's only one way to do it.
The only way to get information, at least currently, the only way we know, would be to write a piece of software that we view as sort of the software equivalent of cancer.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Megan Murphy of Bloomberg News, Julie Bykowitz of the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you make of that wild debate last night in Houston? How do you see the road ahead in the GOP for Clinton and Sanders for Apple? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Megan Murphy, D.C. Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. Megan Murphy, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much.
From Houston, the scene of last night's fiery GOP debate, Julie Bykowitz is with us, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Julie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Megan, and Julie.
Everybody with a lot on the line last night, maybe Marco Rubio most of all. Here he was, one of his attacks on Trump for hiring, he said, undocumented immigrants for one of his big projects.
He hired workers from Poland, and he had to pay $1 million or so in a judgment.
That's wrong.
For hiring.
That's wrong.
That's a fact.
Totally wrong. I've hired tens of thousands of people over my lifetime. Tens of
many
thousands.
Many from other countries
be
instead
quiet.
Of hiring
Just
Americans.
Be quiet. Let me talk.
And Ted Cruz taking his shots among many. Trump makes deals. He'll make deals all over the place.
He is promising if he's elected, he will go and cut deals in Washington. And he's right. He has supported,
deals,
he has given hundreds of thousands of dollars to Democrats. Anyone who really cared about illegal immigration wouldn't be hiring illegal immigrants.
And Trump saying, well, you know, I'm under attack because you guys aren't doing so well.
So let me ask you this, because you're really getting beaten badly. I know you're embarrassed. I know you're embarrassed. But keep fighting. Keep swinging, man. Swing for the fences.
Julie Bykowitz, you were there in Houston. Have you ever seen anything like what we saw last night?
This was by far the most chaotic, disorderly debate of the 10 Republican debates we've had so far. And I was chuckling a little bit to myself when you just replayed that clip of Trump. He was absolutely right. He is getting attacked because he's far ahead in some of the upcoming states that will vote soon. And he's got three wins under his belt. So people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz have absolutely no choice at this point, but to attack him.
You're a basket case, he said to Cruz. Cruz, you know, everybody going at Donald. Trump talking about a joke artist and a liar. Jack Beatty, I guess this is inevitable that he would take the heat, but the way this, the theatrics of this debate season in this party are right out there. Trump's got a lot of reality show experience, and he's willing to sort of shake up the frame.
He sure is. You know, the caterwauling recalled James Joyce's comment that life is an intensely serious low comedy. You know, CNN, in its ratings hunger, didn't dare shut off Trump's mic, so he ranted while Cruz and Rubio spoke. Their attacks on his business career and conservative sincerity, you know, it probably came five debates too late. He's on a fast track to the nomination. You know, if over the next 3 weeks he beats Cruz in Texas, Rubio in Florida, and Kasich in Ohio, the unthinkable, to paraphrase a Washington Post editorial, will become the inevitable.
I want to bring that to you, Megan, but Julie, first, just on the polls, do they show that as a possibility? We've got a dozen states, 11 coming up on Super Tuesday, more right behind. Is Trump in shooting distance of wrapping up the nomination in March?
It sure looks that way. We just did a story today looking very closely at Florida, which Marco Rubio has said is a must-win state for him. He feels very confident there. But there are signs that maybe he shouldn't feel so confident. We took a look at how Florida, in fact, loves political outsiders, like their governor, Rick Scott, who sounds on paper a lot like Donald Trump. And just yesterday, there was a poll out in Florida showing that Trump is well ahead of Rubio. So that's going to be a very exciting state to watch come March 15th.
On Wednesday, at a campaign rally, Ted Cruz took aim at Donald Trump, saying, "This is a circus.
We can't be fooled by P.T. Barnum. The time for the clowns and the acrobats and the dancing bears has passed."
But it was Donald Trump celebrating on Tuesday night in Las Vegas after winning the GOP Nevada caucus.
"We won the evangelicals. We won with young. We won with old. We won with highly educated. We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated. We're the smartest people. We're the most loyal people."
Megan Murphy, how is Washington, D.C. and the Republican establishment there absorbing what we see on the campaign trail in the primary results?
I think it's like the five stages of grief almost, and where they are now is just sheer panic and looking for any legitimate alternative. They've waited too long. They've left it too late. Last night's debate performance by Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio may have been appreciated by the establishment in Washington and donors who are looking for where to put their money. But the fact of the matter is these kind of attacks haven't made a dent in Trump's support so far. We saw him, as he said, won every Democratic in Nevada. He won every Democratic in South Carolina, except for the highly affluent and the very highly educated. This is a train that isn't going to stop until people start grappling with the real fundamentals he's addressing and sort of the shift in American society since the recession and the sort of challenges that everyday workers face.
Julie, what about the merits of the Rubio and Cruz attacks last night? Were they critiques that you could weigh and say, yes, that's a reason? We heard Rubio there on hiring undocumented laborers. And I do see there was a suit that goes back all the way to 1980 when he built Trump Towers, a couple of hundred undocumented Polish workers. A judge ruled against him on that. Does Rubio have a point? Does it matter?
Well, it was interesting that Rubio a couple times during the debate said, Google it. And he's clearly been Googling himself and found that there are lots of stories out there about Donald Trump and his many years of business practices that Rubio believes would concern voters if they actually sat down and read about these things. I think that what we might look for now, though, is, you know, one debate isn't really going to change things. But some of the points brought up by Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, if combined with a multi-million-dollar television advertising effort that, you know, has a sustained sort of drumbeat on these issues, perhaps that will move the needle. But perhaps, as Megan said, it's just too late.
Is there a path to something other than Trump for the GOP if one of these guys drops out? Is there any chance of Cruz or Rubio clearing the way for the other? Julie?
I don't see that happening in the near future. There's no way that Ted Cruz would drop out ahead of Super Tuesday coming up. That's certainly been his game plan, is to do well on Super Tuesday. Now, if he doesn't do well Super Tuesday, he might take a look at whether it makes sense for him to continue. But it looks like right now John Kasich and Marco Rubio are both in it till March 15th, which is coming up fast, but at the same time seems like an awful long way away. And the reason that they're both going to stick around until then is because that's when their home states go to the polls. There's no incentive for either one of them to drop out before then.
A lot of people watching as we barrel now towards Super Tuesday. A lot on the line. Lewis in Atlanta, Georgia is calling. Hi, Lewis. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. You know, it's funny that Cruz took great pride in being the man who single-handedly shut down the United States government, but he can't shut down Donald Trump. And Marco Rubio comes across like a grown-up version, a Latino version of the Leave It to Beaver kid, with Trump serving as the Wally foil to Rubio. This is the most unbelievable election I've ever witnessed. I'm 60 years old. I've never seen anything like this. I'm a Democrat. I'll tell you right up front that. But, I mean, I'm enjoying what's going on the other side. But my last thing to say is those right-wing talk shows that have been spewing the hate talk for years now, created Trump. And they created Cruz. And now they're like terribly scared, running scared of these two guys. But they created Trump and Cruz with their fear-mongering and whatever they do on those shows day after day, night after night.
Lewis, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Donald Trump saying, wait a minute, I'm bringing more people into the political process. Here he was at last night's debate.
New people are coming into the Republican Party. We are building a new Republican Party. A lot of new people are coming in.
Jack, we've got Lindsey Graham. Of course, he's been strong against Trump, but saying this week that the GOP is just going crazy here. Our caller says, well, you know, reaping the whirlwind. What do you see unfolding, Jack?
Well, you see that commentary emerging today. Robert Kagan, a leading neoconservative, is out with a column saying, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton. And the reason is the Republican Party has created this Frankenstein monster. Donald Trump created him by essentially pandering, to pick up what Lewis said, to the worst instincts of white voters, their xenophobia, their racial resentment, their anger at their lowering status in a browning America.
But of course, Megan, you've got people who are saying, look, we want somebody who will break out of the same old patterns and do something different for us. I mean, yes, maybe there are darker motives here as well, but you can feel that impatience with the old politics, Megan.
Absolutely. And the echoes of this aren't even, they're in talk shows and some of that was mentioned by the caller, but they're also in Europe, where this rise of this strain of populism on both the left and the right has been growing since the crisis. And what you see is people rejecting establishment politics, rejecting establishment figures, rejecting even the establishment way of typically funding campaigns in every level.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, fiery politics before Super Tuesday coming right up. Apple versus the FBI, the Supreme Court scrum, wild weather in the South, more mass shootings, Kalamazoo and Kansas. Wow, just it is rough. Megan Murphy is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News, Julie Bykowitz, National Political Reporter for the Associated Press in Houston, Texas last night for that debate. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. What do you see in all this politics, Republican and Democratic Party politics? Is the country getting what it needs from this primary season? Are you standing with Apple or the FBI on cracking open that cell phone, changing the code? What do you think of Senate Republicans slamming the door on anything to do with a Supreme Court nomination? Julie, give us one more pass, if you would, through the pre-Super Tuesday polling numbers. Where does Trump look strong? Where does he look weak? I've heard some reports that he, you know, looks good in almost every state at this point. What's the picture?
Sure. I think that what we're seeing out of Texas, where I am, is that Cruz may pull it out here. Mm-hmm. Most of the political strategists that I talk to here in Texas think he'll eke out a win. And that's a good optics thing for him to win his home state,
big state, you bet.
Exactly. But at the same time, what he really needs, and it looks a little bit out of his reach at this point, is to run away with Texas to capture more of the state's delegates. It doesn't look like he'll be able to quite run away from Trump at this point. They'll be pretty close, but most people here expect Ted Cruz to eke it out. Jumping over to some of the other states, Trump is looking surprisingly strong, and that's bad news for Ted Cruz, whose strategy all along has been to do quite well on March 1st.
Jack Beatty, do you see a speed bump out there somewhere for Donald Trump, a significant one that could take him off the rails?
I don't at this point. He has momentum. And it's, you know, he has a unique Teflon. I mean, he has said things, right from the day he announced his candidacy, and he said, I'll get Mexico to pay for the wall. You'd think that would prima facie be disqualifying. No one could believe that. Not so. Whatever it is, he is tapped into, and you're right, Tom, there's a positive element in it, an element for the people wanting change. And by change, they mean change in the idiom, even, of politics, in what politics is all about. And he's answering that really almost rage among Republican voters.
And there it is. Tom in Columbia, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Everybody seems to be freaking out about President Trump, so to speak. But I'm more freaking out if it was a President Cruz. One of the first things the president's going to have to deal with is the budget as well as the debt ceiling limit, since it was kicked down after the election.
Yep.
Cruz has already shown a tendency to shut down the government as senator. Would he do the same? Would he actually veto a bill that would extend the government debt and have enough Tea Partiers to help prevent an override of the veto? So that's the really scary thing, is the first thing the president's going to be dealing with is the budget. Will we have a government shutdown? Will we default on our debt just for pure principle based from Mr. Cruz, who quite frankly reminds me quite a bit of from the 50s what we used to have.
Ted Cruz has proven he will stand a long time on principle. Megan Murphy, have people in Washington begun to do policy calculations? Well, if it were President Trump, that would mean X, Y, or Z. Can you tell out of what he's shown of his plans? Or for that matter, Cruz and our caller's point.
You know, people have started to do those calculations kind of on the back of an envelope, because with Donald Trump, he hasn't really released a lot of full policy proposals. You saw him last night really struggle on, in particular, health care and what he would do, and on the Middle East as well, and how he would combat ISIS and how he would deal with the Palestinian crisis. But one thing that people in Washington are really animated about is getting in the White House. And trust me, people are doing those calculations every day. I think the point raised about the budget is a good one. Obviously, we also have the Supreme Court vacancy, which it looks like an incoming president may also have to deal with. I think a President Trump has been, I think one thing he will improve on in the coming weeks is he was burned last night on policy. He's a quick study. I think he'll get better as time goes on.
Of course, the way the Trump message gets heard and gets magnified around the country, interesting in itself, this story I read in the Washington Post this week about a basketball game out in Iowa, Perry High School. Unusual for that part of Iowa, racially diverse high school team. And the opposing team, this is reported by Iowa Television's WHO, fans chanting at this, sort of the white team chanting at the brown team, Trump, Trump, Trump. Latino and Native Americans and African American kids on the other team, who took it as a kind of racist chant at them. I mean, Jack, this is weird. I can't remember a version of that where politics came in quite presidential politics onto a, let's say, a local basketball game and a candidate's name as a taunt.
It was a disturbing. I have the story in front of me, and this is also comes the week that David Duke, of all people, the Ku Klux Klan man, in his radio show said it would be treason to their heritage, quote, if whites don't vote for Trump. You know, all that is disturbing. But to me, the most disturbing thing about Trump is his almost naked relish of cruelty. And this was on display in Nevada this week. A protester is being led out of his rally. He said, I'd like to punch him in the face. You know what they used to do to guys like that in the old days? They'd be carried out on a stretcher. You know, that ugly moment, that's a warning of what to expect from a President Trump. As the Washington Post noted, he wants the United States to commit war crimes, including torture and the murder of innocent relatives of suspected terrorists.
I guess you could read him that way. But he's saying, look, make me president and I'll be presidential. It is not just drama on the Republican side. There are high stakes on the Democrats' side as well. Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton headed right into South Carolina now, and then Super Tuesday right behind. Large African-American vote in South Carolina, of course. And here was Hillary Clinton on Wednesday in West Columbia saying there's a need for a big range of reforms to help African-Americans.
We need to address the full range of issues, reforming our criminal justice system, breaking the school-to-prison pipeline, and working to substitute a cradle-to-college pipeline.
And Bernie Sanders, CNN Town Hall on Tuesday in South Carolina, looking to make inroads himself right there.
We have a criminal justice system which is broken, that there is something very wrong when African-Americans in South Carolina and around the country get nervous about walking down the street or going into their car and being stopped by a police officer. That should not be happening in America now.
Julie Bykowitz, what about the Democrats' side of the ledger? We had a pretty hot debate yesterday with Jonathan Tassini, who is out as an official surrogate for the Sanders campaign, and Paul Starr of Princeton, I should have said yesterday, served as a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton administration back in 1993. His preference pretty clearly, not Bernie Sanders. Jonathan Tassini, very strong for Bernie Sanders. When you look at Democrats around this choice, Julie, do you see a reflection of this fierce contest inside the GOP and the sort of dismay at the options at the newcomer, or are traditional Democrats taking Bernie Sanders on more calmly?
I think there are incredible parallels with what's going on the Republican side, and in this way in particular. It's that people around the country are just very fed up with the political system. They see Washington as a cartel, as Ted Cruz says. Both Democrats and Republicans feel like they are not being represented. They're sick of it. They want to choose people or support people, at least, maybe if not ultimately vote for, but give a big boost to people who are plainly talking about how Washington is not treating the rest of the country well and isn't looking out for their interests. And that's what Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have both been able to do so well in this election cycle.
Andrew in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Andrew, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to raise the issue of the phenomenon of Donald Trump. I mean, if you really think about it, you know, being in media, he is the direct result of the way the mainstream media capitalizes on figures like this. You know, I mean, the circus nature of these debates is a result of the mainstream media hosting them. So, you know, they've capitalized on this whole Trump phenomenon. And in the last two or three terms, they have managed to single-handedly create a political eyesore for the public. And I would like to see more public networks host these debates, and maybe we can come up with a more honest assessment of these guys that are running for president.
But what are you going to do, Andrew, if you've got a confrontation as feisty as last night? Now, no question, the big networks have realized that these draw big crowds, and they've capitalized on that. But, I mean, just because you had more sober interrogators doesn't necessarily mean the guys on stage would be calmer with the stakes that are out there right now, Andrew.
Well, look at the way they tailor their questions. Now, I mean, a majority of the questions that were directed towards the debaters last night, they in some way instigate the other politician across the board. So, you know, and they managed to do a good job at kind of avoiding that direct confrontation by the question. I mean, they managed to confront each other in other ways. But the questions themselves, I mean, it would be, I think they would just be tailored completely different set up with a public network.
Andrew, we've got it. Megan Murphy, do you think there's another way to conduct these debates, given the personalities and the stakes that are up there?
I think this is a really important issue, and it's correct to say that in many ways the media has helped create and continue the momentum and the sort of juggernaut that is Donald Trump. But you have to also look at it on the other side, which is that so many of the issues that he is really resonating with people with have been so undercovered by the media, whether that's wage stagnation, whether that's the declining labor force participation rate, whether that's labor share of income, and what working people and working class people are really grappling with in this country. So it's kind of both ways. We've seen that this cycle, he's benefited hugely from just appearing on television shows, endless talking about him. But he's also addressing an undercurrent in American society that hasn't been served.
People are kind of starving for that. Larry in North Tonawanda, New York. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a lifelong Democrat, very Bernie, but I will vote for Trump before I vote for Hillary and the system that put her there.
You cut out for a second there, Larry. Did you say very pro-Bernie?
I am very pro-Bernie, but I will vote for Trump before I vote for Hillary.
Explain your calculus to us exactly, Larry.
Trump represents what Bernie does, which is to shake up Washington, and I wish Bernie had the guts to run against a do-nothing Congress like Truman did.
Larry, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, all right, here's where we are. Where Larry, lifelong Democrat and strong pro-Bernie Sanders, is ready to vote for Trump over Hillary Clinton, and right there you have the sort of condensate of all the dissatisfactions and the sort of strange bedfellows maybe they're creating, Chuck.
You do, and you know, and right there at the center of it, you have the dissatisfaction, not just with Hillary Clinton, but among many Democrats with the Clintons. We're going through a kind of revisionist history of the Clinton era, aren't we? We're finding out about the crime bill and the, you know, super predators, and we'll throw away the key. We're finding about deregulating Wall Street. We're finding about you know, the cuts in capital gains taxes and all the rest. And in some strange way, this is all coming down on Mrs. Clinton, and she's doing everything she can, it seems to me, to make it worse for herself. Today, the New York Times, in a stinging editorial, says, Mrs. Clinton, show voters those transcripts, the speeches she gave to Goldman Sachs and others, and they point out very well, by stonewalling on them, she's playing into the hands of those who say she's not trustworthy and makes her own rules.
Well, we've got lots of weight in Washington against a door this week, and with a political face to it as well. Of course, Antonin Scalia, with his death comes a vacancy on the Supreme Court, and Republicans, after wavering a little bit this week, saying, no way, no how, we're not going to have hearings, we're not even going to talk to a nominee. This was Kentucky Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on behalf of GOP leaders on Tuesday, saying, wait for the president's successor.
I believe the overwhelming view of the Republican Conference of the Senate in the Senate is that this nomination should not be filled, this vacancy should not be filled by this lame duck president.
A lame duck president with almost a year to go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. That president, the next day, talking with the press with the King of Jordan at his side in the Oval Office, said Senate's forgetting what its duty is, what his is.
I'm going to do my job. I'm going to nominate somebody and let the American people decide as to whether that person is qualified.
Megan Murphy, is there room for something to be worked out here? Will the Republicans stand by this assertion that they will not entertain a nominee?
I think they'll stand by it until you see the kind of public reaction we did see with the shutdown over Obamacare. You know, will the American people stand for this kind of politicking with the Supreme Court, which, rightly or wrongly, American people have always held a little bit separate from the politics of Washington? And I think the issue that facing Obama on the flip side is, do I want to nominate someone and subject them to this kind of scrutiny if they have zero chance of getting confirmed? And that can be a very ugly process.
We saw just for a second this week, Megan, Brian Sandoval, the Republican governor in Nevada, the name floated out there. He said, no, thank you. Was that ever for real that he'd talk with them? Or is that just a way to say, hey, the GOP senators won't even take a Republican?
I think that was gamesmanship to show exactly the point you just said. But look, Obama has his legacy in mind. He sees a court that split 4-4 and with the chance to cement his legacy with a liberal court. I do think it will be hard for him to nominate anyone who's not going to secure that legacy of a liberal court for generations to come.
Julie, do you see politics forcing the Republicans' hand in the Senate? Do you sense that it's that hot an issue on the trail, people saying, come on, you've got to do it?
Not at this point. I think it's a little bit early for that. It certainly could evolve into that type of an issue where there's just a growing drumbeat for the Senate to do something, to actually kind of fulfill their duty on this, at least by having hearings, at least by acting like they're thinking about a nominee pick. But at this point, I think it's a little bit early for that on the trail.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the court standoff now at this point?
Well, I would have thought that, sure, the kind of, you know, good government pressure would change things. But good government pressure from editorial boards, that's not the coin in politics anymore. It's partisanship. And I think the Republican senators are faithfully reflecting what Republican-based voters want, which is to stop Obama from appointing anyone by any means possible.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 106-year-old Virginia McLaurin, born in South Carolina in 1909, danced with President Obama and the First Lady at the White House. She said she could hardly contain herself, said she was happy enough to shout.
I said I was happy enough to shout, but it was the most happiest thing I have ever met in my life to meet a black president.
That was something to see. Emojis for Facebook. Conan O'Brien joked about the emojis that Facebook rolled out. More than just a like button to click.
Facebook has now added buttons for love, wow, ha-ha, sad, and angry. In other words, Facebook copied the emotional journey of any Adele album.
And speaking of Adele, she dominated the Brit Awards, their pop music Grammys, winning 4 awards, including Best British Female Solo Artist. She used her time to support another female pop star, Kesha, who's been battling producer Dr. Luke over her contract and allegations of sexual abuse.
I'd like to take a quick second just to thank my management and my record label for embracing the fact that I'm a woman and being encouraged by it. And I'd also like to take this moment to publicly support Kesha. Thank you very much.
Adele takes a stand there. We're looking at a week in the news, fiery politics before Super Tuesday, Apple versus the FBI, the Supreme Court, scrum, wild weather, more mass shootings, Kalamazoo and Kansas this week. Julie Bykowitz is with us from the Associated Press, Megan Murphy from Bloomberg News, Jack Beatty's here. You can join us as well. Are you standing with Apple or the FBI on cracking open that cell phone, changing the code? What about the shooters, the Supreme Court? The Syria ceasefire? Have you survived the wild weather this week? Are you ready for Chris Rock at the all-white Oscars? I want to get to Apple and the FBI, but I just have to just stick for a second here on that tape that was came to light this week. Joe Biden back in 1992, when there was another court issue. He was, of course, Democratic senator then. He chaired the Judiciary Committee. And here's what he had to say in 92, at least in part, about this kind of moment.
Action on a Supreme Court nomination must be put off until after the election campaign is over. That is what is fair to the nominee and essential to the process.
Megan Murphy, what the Republicans love that, played it all week long. What do the Democrats, what did Joe Biden have to say?
They're trying to distance themselves from that as quickly as they can and saying, you know, the words are the words, but they don't apply in this situation. Look, it's unhelpful. And we all know the political temperature here and what's going to happen. And the thing is, this is going to shape up as a very, very nasty fight. And I think everyone's just doing their best they can to sort of gauge what can and can't be done and who almost they're willing to almost publicly sacrifice to this nomination should Obama decide to proceed, which we fully expect he will.
Of course, everybody has some tape maybe to answer for here, because I mean, the then ranking Republican on that same committee, Joe Biden's back then, was Strom Thurmond, Senator, said the opposite about holding up a Supreme Court justice nominee back then. He said, oh, no, you know, don't change the process for election year expediency. Here's Strom Thurmond.
It is this process, a process which should not be changed for election year expediency, which has signified the majority of our system of government.
That was the Republican voice ranking then. Richard in Lithonia, Georgia. Richard, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you. I was calling about Supreme Court nominee.
Yes.
Nomination that President Obama is going to go forward with. Mm-hmm. I find it very strange that's one of his responsibilities, is when you have a case like this, and now that the Republicans are saying that they shouldn't, he should wait till we have a new president. I think people, especially African Americans, need to pay close attention to this because of some of the comments that the Antonin, even though he's gone now, Antonin Scalia made about education and how, you know, African Americans were better off going to an African American school. And it's important that we elect somebody who is going to be fair for everybody, you know, for the United States of America, not one class of people.
Richard, we hear your hope right there. Mitch McConnell this week, Jack, calling Antonin Scalia one of a kind. Maybe as if to say, and we need that kind again to replace him. What about that assertion that, you know, we've got a court balance and it is what it is and it what it should be, what it must stay?
Well, you know, it's a decisive vote, and that the court has been the last bastion, really, of conservative Republican resistance to the changes that have been happening in the country. I mean, for a generation and more, really since 1970, we've had a conservative court with some changes. And this will, if Obama, if his Democratic, the replacement puts in a new justice, that will upset the balance. That's a decisive switch in the balance of power between the parties, between conservatism and progressivism.
It's happened before, right? I mean, the court has never been...
So there's an ultimacy about it. I think that, there's a piece by a McConnell biographer, wrote a biography of him called The Cynic, saying, this guy doesn't care about anything except getting elected. But then the biographer said, well, here's something he may care about even more than holding on to the Senate, preventing that tip vote from going onto the court.
And it's in everybody's lap right now. I mean, one of the cases that could end up before the high court, just blowing up this week, Apple versus the Justice Department over this cell phone, and really taking a strong stand. But we had the FBI Director James Comey, this was testifying yesterday before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, saying the court request, his request for Apple to help the FBI get into that phone of one of the San Bernardino shooters is about looking for evidence, nothing more.
The San Bernardino litigation is not about us trying to send a message or establish some precedent. It really isn't. It's about trying to be competent in investigating something.
And, of course, Tim Cook at the head of Apple saying, whoa, it's about a lot more than that. Here he was talking with ABC on Wednesday. Big implications, said the Apple CEO.
This case is not about one phone. This case is about the future. What is at stake here is, can the government compel Apple to write software that we believe would make hundreds of millions of customers vulnerable around the world, including the U.S., and also trample civil liberties that are at the basic foundation of what this country was made on.
Julie Bykowitz, I don't know how closely you're able to follow this along with everything going on the campaign trail, but what do you see here? Business interests, constitutional interests, a legitimate FBI request or an overreach? There are giant questions here. How's it shaping up?
Well, these are absolutely huge questions, and we're asking our fairly dysfunctional government to answer them right now. I think there's a lot of danger here, with the topic as we move on from it, just to see what the government is able to do at this point. Like I said, it's fairly dysfunctional. They haven't been able to agree on much of anything. But I am seeing on the Republican side, at least at the debate last night, all of the candidates on the stage were saying, really, Apple, you do need to turn over this information as the court has ordered. With some caveats, Ted Cruz saying that he wants it very specific to this case and not some sort of broad key, which the government has said is indeed what they're after.
Drew in Austin, Texas. Drew, you're on the air. What do you think, sir?
Hi, Tom. I don't think the FBI is after the information on this particular phone. The FBI could go and get the information it needs about who those people were talking to off of a carrier. They could just subpoena the records from a carrier and get the information that way. I think Apple is not interested in what's inside the safe. I think they're interested in acquiring a key to all the safes.
Apple or the FBI is interested in that?
I mean, the FBI. Mm-hmm. The FBI is interested in acquiring the key to all these safes. The shooters are dead. There's no criminal investigation going on. They may be looking for the mythical conspirators, I guess, but they could obtain the information about the contact, who they called, who they texted. They could obtain that information from whatever carrier was using that telephone.
Drew, I appreciate your call. Megan, I don't know about mythical conspirators. I mean, we just don't know. They're saying we do need to know, and the phone would be helpful in that. I don't know how deep into the technology of this Washington has immersed itself at this point, Megan. There's this assertion that the FBI is using this. Comey is saying no, but that they're using this to kind of crack open this whole realm and have access to it versus just getting Syed Farouk's data.
I mean, look, this case is going to be seminal for several reasons. One is that for the FBI side of this argument, and people are right in saying they've wanted this key to encrypted information, they wanted a backdoor into these kind of systems. Well, look, we're dealing with a mass murder, and we're dealing with, we don't know what's on that phone. There could be pictures, there could be photos, there could be photos of people they dealt with, messages they exchanged, hard drive material that's saved on that phone, because the iPhone is an incredibly powerful computer in and of itself. And the FBI has come down hard on this case, but because they really believe as well that they're going to have public sentiment on their side in the wake of this tragedy. On Apple's side, it's going to be very interesting to see how much damage they take to their brand in the U.S. versus Europe, which has very strong feelings about privacy and sees this case as a lightning rod as well, and the sentiment in Europe very much wants Apple to hold firm. I think in the U.S., it's a much closer sentiment gauge between what portion of the population support what they're doing and what portion of the population support the FBI.
Spencer, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I think this is a severe case of product injury. I think that this phone is more than a phone. It's more than tapping a wire. This is an information security device, and that was the whole purpose in the design, and you destroy the whole functionality of the phone if you allow other agencies or countries to have access to somebody's private information. It's almost like if I sold you a gun and then I went to a law enforcement agency and I asked them if they, you know, couldn't find somebody that would create a device that would disable any gun at any time. It destroys the usefulness of the gun.
Jim, we've got it. Jack Beatty, I have to say, I'm really torn on this, and I understand they want to have a thorough investigation, and San Bernardino was terrible. On the other hand, everybody's carrying these phones now, and if the government can get too easily into them, they are more than just an old-fashioned landline. I mean, it's almost like we'd all be wearing an electronic monitor around all the time, a smart ankle bracelet for the government. They can say, hand it over and see everywhere we've been, what we've done. I mean, it can seem like a lot to ask, Jack.
It can indeed. And, you know, tough cases make bad law. And Congress, Dianne Feinstein and Richard Burr are talking about legislation here that would essentially compel companies in situations like this to turn over, open the phone. And meanwhile, there seems to be a compromise position emerging, one that recognizes the dilemma you just on the other hand, inextricable character of this, and that is to have a commission to sort of embalm the issue, you know, or kind of a national commission to blather about it, but that may just put off the evil day when the issue will come to the floor again. And in the meantime, as the Times has been reporting, the walls are going to get bigger and bigger around these phones. It's going to be harder and harder to crack them.
Apple already working on the next iteration. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Marty in Norman, Oklahoma. Marty, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I have no fear of Islamic terrorists coming to my town, small town in Oklahoma, but I do have a real fear of crazy white guys walking around with assault rifles and pistols because they seem to be on a hair trigger and they seem to be indiscriminate in what they do. And I'll just take, that's my comment, and I'll take the, I'll listen to the answers off air.
It was a very tough week on that front. Assault-style rifle in Heston, Kansas, and we saw three dead there, plus the shooter, now identified as Cedric Ford, and, of course, Kalamazoo, the Uber driver. Just unbelievable. Driving around in between fares, between delivering passengers, going on this shooting rampage. Here was the mayor of Kalamazoo. This is Bobby Hopewell talking with Michigan Radio on Tuesday about the mass shooting in his city, lamenting that Kalamazoo is now on that unfortunate list of cities fallen victim to mass gun violence.
This random act that has thrust us in the middle of this universe of problems as it relates to gun violence. Over 40 communities already this year. This is just sad, and we never thought we would be on that list. We never thought that, but we also don't live in a bubble. Our world has gotten smaller, and it just happens to be that ugly and evil landed here.
The death and pain, very real. Three dead, 14 in the hospital we heard there in Heston, Kansas. Here was a woman reunited with her husband at the scene of the shooting during an interview with local CBS affiliate KWCH.
He said he's okay. He did say somebody next to him got shot. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Julie, I mean, that
that palpable fear that we heard right there from Oklahoma that, sure, you can talk about terrorists, but what about the guy next door?
Well, this makes me think that maybe we will start hearing again more about mental health issues. For a while, that flared up on the campaign trail as something that was being discussed, and it's partly in tandem with addiction issues in New Hampshire. So I'll be interested to see if mental health and sort of keeping people well returns to the dialogue on the campaign trail.
Oh, it just goes on. Megan, a quick word on the Syrian ceasefire. It's supposed to take effect tomorrow. John Kerry's talking about it. Is Washington looking at that and thinking that is real or just another, I don't know what, diplomatic dance while people die?
A diplomatic dance while people die. It's a sad way of putting it. I mean, I think Washington's looking at this like our allies in Europe are looking at it and Russia's looking at it. Is people are hopeful it will hold, but they know it probably won't. And hopefully, will it lay the groundwork for something that's more lasting, more permanent? Perhaps so, but we have shown how difficult that is there.
Volatile times all over the place. I want to thank all three of you. Megan Murphy with Bloomberg News, Washington Bureau Chief there. Megan, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Julie Baikowitz, National Political Reporter for the Associated Press. Great to have you with us from Houston, Texas, Julie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, it's always great to have you right here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can subscribe to our new Week in the News newsletter featuring highlights from this past week and this week from presidential election years past. Check it out at our site, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Caroline Bechtel and Maeve Pages. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks so much for being with us today. Check us out on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm there at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.